The book was written a couple of years ago, well, 3 years ago, on Marsh McLuhan by a Canadian writer named Douglas Copeland, who is the one who wrote the book Generation X back in early 90s, I think. So 20 years ago, Generation X was caused by Douglas Copeland. So he became famous. Well, some publisher wanted him to do a book on McLuhan in 2010. The book comes out. It's a disgusting book. And Ion is so pissed. You got to hear Ion just tears the book apart. McLuhan had the longest brain surgery in November 1967, 21 and a half, almost 22 hours, because he had a tumor, but it turned out to be benign. But he was doing some weird stuff in his class the year or two before that. He'd suddenly stop in mid-sentence in class, make a Nazi salute, and be frozen there for a minute or two, and then his arm would come down, and he'd pick up the thought right where he left off. So the premise of this biography is that McLuhan was an aberrated, weird, autistic, screwed-up guy with a weird extra ventricle in his neck and all this stuff. He goes into all this physiology and explains his pre-Ionic prophecy as human screw-up. And you don't hear Ion promote McLuhan, even though he acknowledged McLuhan in his Rogue Ion show, M-O-I, McLuhan on Ion. But he won't take this little pipsqueak saying these things about McLuhan. So we have a whole revelation about McLuhan as a result of this. Okay, here we go.
There is a new book out on Marshall McLuhan.
Dun, dun, dun. We've been waiting.
The book goes into his biological eccentricities, his genetic thing. It takes a whole different angle. So a sentence from the book says, Marsh McLuhan's brain was fueled by fresh blood from the heart through not one but two arteries at the base of his skull, a trait in the mammalian world found mostly in cats and rarely in human beings. In my understanding of the brain, we lay tracks.
You lay conduit, yes.
Would that mean that you could create anomalies like McLuhan had?
Based on what empirical reference are they saying that there's double carotid arteries for Marshall McLuhan?
When he had a few strokes and this and that, they noticed it.
Uh-huh.
Marshall McLuhan's brain was fueled by fresh blood from the heart through not one but two arteries at the base of his skull.
They weren't two arteries. It was a division. It's the same thing that they use bypass, where they bypass around. It just divided. And it was because of the extra calcification of his arteries. It was not two, it was one divided into two halves. So that's all that was.
Is that odd, what they witnessed?
No, Bob.
Well,
if you're long enough, you're bound to see most anything.
But they make a big deal out of it, so I will...
Well, imagine that.
Let me click on the article and get that actual section so that we get it right.
Starts to sound like us.
In what way?
Frivolity. Why did you say you sound like us? Because this extreme that you're now referencing to figure out the dynamic of why they said Marshall McLuhan laying on the autopsy table calculated that he was this insane from the pea brain human creator different than everyone else. And what we're trying to say is it's just not so. Everyone has anomalies within their genome structure, but that doesn't make one less than or one more than because of the way their blood flows.
I don't know why you said that, frivolous. I know how people would think you were frivolous from some of your answers, but what prompted you to bring up that notion that I would have to ask you about it?
Because you're making a reference of the book as an end-all that you want clarification regarding. And we made the statement regarding the book that it was a bit frivolous. And then we said, and in that answer that you're now fixing to look up to validate or vindicate to clean up, sounds like us when we, like the author of the McLuhan II regime, sounds frivolous. That's all. We're making a parallel.
In other words, your response about that statement could sound frivolous to him if he heard you, because he thinks he's serious and you're saying, nah, it's not an issue.
Right. It's frivolous.
Okay. Marshall had another health scare in 1971. An angiogram revealed that his carotid artery was blocked.
Now, carotid.
Are we talking about the splitting of a carotid artery? is it a carotid artery? So I know that where we are. Okay.
Yeah.
So it was blah. But it was during the discovery of this that surgeons discovered his feline or cat-like blood circulation. His external carotid artery, the artery that supplies blood to the face, scalp, and jaw, had formed huge connecting channels through the left base of his skull and inside his skull.
And this is exactly what we just said. It split.
Had it not been for this one in a billion vascularization, what's that?
Where the vascular system reroutes its pathways of flow.
So this splitting of the artery can be called vascularization.
It is.
Okay, if it hadn't been for this one in a billion, Marshall's brain would have been toast long ago. He considered this vascularization to be a miracle. Who's to say it wasn't? So, it was not a miracle. Mm-hmm. It happens often in people.
It was the fastest path to his joy.
This splitting of the artery, carotid artery, is normal.
It's possible. We can't say it's normal because not everyone has that. But the only reason that that split was because of the calcification of his artery anyway. And you know which arteries those are. If you look at your neck and you look up and you feel, if you use your index finger, you can feel your pulse and your carotid artery. That's the one that we're speaking of. The stroke business is the telltale signage of that blockage that was. I mean, he'd have done well if he'd just had a baby aspirin every day and it would have never come up or had to split. But that it did split is wonderful, delicious, the human creator working out a solution. But if you use that anomaly of how he was different and one in a billion has that, and that's why Marshall McLuhan was special, Marshall McLuhan himself would laugh you out of his space.
What was unique that happened, but did his being created that?
Well, of course.
You can make your artery go another direction, do other things.
You most certainly can.
So he considered it a bit miracle, but that was his cover story. He knew it was something he could create.
Mm-hmm.
So it just simply redirected itself to get around the block.
Mm-hmm.
Had it not been for this, he would have been toast. Yeah, but it didn't happen. He created it. This thing that happened earlier, his blackouts, there were underlying biological reasons for the acceleration of Marshall's tics and eccentricities. Throughout the early 1960s, he began, for lack of a better word, to freeze when in public, either teaching or in social situations. He'd be talking and then he would stop. His eyes would go blank and then after a minute or two, he'd continue where he'd left off. It was disconcerting and worried those close to him. Medically, there were three potential causes for these freezings. One, perhaps they were mini strokes, or they may have been petite mal seizures, minor epileptic seizures, or they could have been related to a benign brain tumor the size of a lemon found in his brain later on in the 60s. With each event, Marshall became a bit more of a prisoner of the wiring and plumbing of his head. Well, that's not true, is it?
Well, of course not.
Why was he going blank? And there were other stories I read that he would be saying...
Mayor asked his daughter, Mary, he would do that for his inflections, to center up his next path that he was fixing to run through. The way he always did it, that wasn't something odd. He would always play it to get everybody's attention.
Now...
He was playing the stage. That's what Mary said.
I don't remember that, but probably. So here's... in class, he would freeze. Is it true that his arm would go up like a Hitler salute?
Any time.
And he'd freeze, and the students would get nervous and think that he'd freaked out.
Well, they'd pay attention to what he was saying and catch up to what he'd already said, and then he would continue on from there. So he had their complete and undivided attention for this new point. And it would always be in the crux of some silliness that he was trying to... point out that they weren't going to get unless they all froze like a deer in the headlights to see the car coming.
To do that is so manipulative. People not thinking he was manipulating that them, they would worry that it was something unconscious, that he was out of control. But you're saying he was in total control.
And the worry for him, but them in their, but him in their undivided attention. See, Marshall wasn't worried about it. If someone else
was comedically, almost consciously doing this for effect.
Yeah, and then he got so used to it, it became normal. And then there you go.
And then people wouldn't pay attention as much.
But he always knew how to hold it. He always worked the room, Bob. You know that.
That's the point. He's working the room. All right. Could Marshall drive a car?
He didn't choose to, but he could.
I thought he could, and he didn't. One couldn't be bothered, so others did it.
Well, no, he was always thinking. He was always in this place, and sometimes he enjoyed his spirits a little much.
So it was wise not to.
Well, it was just a practical application. You could drive a car too, Bob, but do you know? But you could.
Because I'm always thinking.
Unlike your author of this book, which now set all the frailties of Marshall McLuhan to the point that his schizophrenia caused all this mind-fucking going on to such a degree that it's a thousand wonders that he ever got a sentence out. And they're basically undoing the marvelousness that was Marshall McLuhan. You start running that up and down the post a little while, and next thing you know, you're like, he wasn't special, he was fruitcake.
Yeah.
And what he had to say was just foolishness, and that foolishness didn't mean anything to anything. It would be any more than hearing bad words come out of someone suffering from Tourette syndrome and making them be the new comic relief for the stand-up show. It undoes the greatness that was the power that was Marshall McLuhan that everybody, well, three of you are all smitten with these days.
So is there an agenda by someone?
Selling books.
Yeah, selling books, but they're not out to smear his reputation in some way.
So you go into the book and you're talking about a lemon-sized brain tumor that couldn't allow cognizant thought. How is that not a bit salacious?
Is there someone who set out to smear Marshall's reputation and encourage this author's angle? Other than making money, is there someone who wanted to nail
him? No. There ain't but three people going to read the book anyway, so it really doesn't matter what they want to do. Really, if you think there's this vast domain that are these McLuhanites, and Bob, once you get two steps past your blogs, there ain't nobody.
Oh, we know that he's not well known, yeah.
Yeah.
But he is cited in the regular media by journalists and that, but nobody goes into what he's saying.
Whoopee.
I know, he's quoted a lot, but my friend told me there's not a day, or maybe he said a week, and a few days go by without a mention of McLuhan by some journalist in passing, referring to his ideas. He is an archetype on that level. But the readers don't know who he is, you could say. There's no insidious plan to ruin him because he's not a big deal, so no one would want to ruin his reputation.
And if they did, who would know that they were trying?
Yeah. So, I know this author even says he wanted to come up with a different approach. Is there something about this person, Douglas Copeland, that made him take this approach? Is he personally trying to deflate McLuhan's ideas?
Not in his audience of three, no.
I mean, well, the non-audience. Is he trying to do something with them?
No.
So why did he come up with this angle?
Something to do.
Just another way to look at it.
Keep typing, it'll work out.
Okay, now, can you describe, Marshall had two or three other families in other worlds. Did his wife notice that he was gone from his bed?
She was real weird about that.
I mean, she didn't want to know about it.
Well, yes, but no. She was very, very specific that her role as a wife was being good Catholic, so that's an oxymoron, but being in that place, it was important that she be available or connected to her husband. So she tried to make sure she went to bed when he did and all that kind of stuff.
But if he did go to other worlds, he wouldn't do it at night?
You can go to another world, have another family, be gone 2 weeks, and come back in 1 minute.
But Corinne never noticed that about Marshall.
That she spoke of out loud.
She might have noticed it.
Yes.
Yeah, I think there was a rumor that he would get up early and not sleep much.
Right. That's right.
Would he do it in his office?
Sure, Bob.
Yeah. But he was pretty skillful at it.
Guess where he liked to do it the best? Is in the car when someone else was driving.
So he's pretty skillful at it.
For being a paraplegic, run over with brain tumors and split his aneurysms and his stents and his leftness and his Heil Hitler grand mal seizures that he would engage from time to time. Funny how he would sacrifice his health just to get a laugh in a line. We're going to milk that for a while. You know that, don't you?
How are we going to milk that? What do you mean?
It'll come up. When
ridiculous book.
Yes. And we knew it was coming. We were just trying to not hasten its knowingness in you and the two other people on the planet that listen to McLuhan.
Say that again.
We did not want to hasten your attention to this work because we knew you'd get to it soon enough. And we'd rather you, all the days that you didn't, that you had before you got to this work, we knew would serve you immensely well. So.
It's a bit of a distraction.
But well, it's delicious. We're not fussing. We're just saying, move on.
When I read it and I discussed it with a friend, we thought, well, maybe we'll do an analysis of this and I can make fun of it. But you're giving me more material to work with. That's good. But
of course.
Not a priority.
But it's still fun.
Now, Edgar Allan Poe was considered, at least according to Marshall's literary criticism, he was the inspiration for what were known as the symbolists, the famous French poets Baudelaire, Charles Baudelaire, Arthur Rimbaud, another guy named Lautrement, a whole bunch of them.
Rimbaud. Yeah. Don't forget Chaucer, Geoffrey Chaucer.
He was known to have lived at the time pre-Henry VIII, so we're talking the 19th century. Now, maybe he was resonant with it. But here's the point. So you had these symbolists 150 years ago who were influenced by Edgar Allan Poe. And then we have Antonin Artaud, who we brought up on Wednesday, and he was a parallel worlder. He was influenced by these poets. And then James Joyce was, and McLuhan. Is there a common thread among these symbolists that they were parallel worlders?
There are those who lived their lives in such a way that they would be known as what you call a symbologist. Now, a symbologist is one who looks at every symbol and then applies a dynamic into the creature comforted now regime of knowing. That's appropriate, and yes, that goes all through the Illuminati, that goes all through those splints of figuring things out. And a masterful symbologist would see every anomaly and sort of be able to put together the lines and spaces. So if that's what you're talking about, absolutely every single time without fail or exception, that's not quite the way you're laying it out. So that's why we have to make the diversion and say, yes, more times than not, but not every single time. So.
But you're saying the common thing is that if you have a mind that's interested in symbolism, and they do intense study.
They find you. They don't have to intense anything. If you're a symbologist, Bob, the symbols find you. You don't find the symbols.
And when the symbols find you, you start to notice that, and then you find out what they really refer to.
Yeah. No difference than you could be in a store, like a large store, and some people just intuitively know where the restrooms are, the public restrooms. Mm-hmm. And others have to ask five people to get directions, and they're basically boarding their bladder on the way to find the bathroom.
Yeah.
For others, never get directions, have never been there before, walk in and go, well, I think I'll go to the restroom, and they just walk instantaneously to it. There it is, and they're done and good. It's weird where others have to ask and ask.
And then the same applies to accessing riff writing.
Hooray, you got it right first time through.
Those poets, they were probably drug users and that. But the study of symbology, they will come to you, you'll notice it. And if you're lucky, you might find out what the symbols are really for.
They're for whatever you attach to them. So, yes, so what you're saying, when we're okay with those words, what you're saying is that they would come to a place where they'd realize what they are for. They really know, they just haven't attached it to it yet.
They already know, but they haven't attached it to it.
Right.
Is that a statement like, we all parallel world, most of us, but we're not remembering it?
Very good.
That's what you mean.
Yes, indirectly, that's precisely to the
had my personal reading with Cosmic Awareness 40 and a half years ago. They had developed something called the Symbol Project. I think we talked about 143, 144 symbols. And they said that I had an extraordinary action in the Symbol Project. So I've been sort of interested in symbols, but have not studied it in a traditional way, done my own way of doing it. So learning about symbols took me 40 years, but...
55 minutes, you just enjoyed it for 40 years.
That finding was indicated 40 and a half years ago in that reading.
Yeah.
Extraordinary Action, a Symbolic Project. Well, if we go public with this information, we're the first to publicly explain the role of symbols. So that would be anticipated by that statement, Extraordinary Action in the Symbolic Project. Because they're actually going to do something with symbols that's never been done on a public level.
Public level, yeah.
So a Cosmic Awareness, whatever that was coming through Wurzburg, anticipated that, predicted it.
Sure.
The riff writing that Marshall enjoyed, did he embed that in his work?
Tried to, without saying it. He did it, but he didn't want to say it.
Take the concept, the medium is the message. Does that have riff writing embedded in it?
Yes.
Okay, so could you elaborate on that?
No.
Why?
Well, because it just is. And the elaboration is the confounding that would confuse rather than help people get it. So to spend a lot of energy of how it confounded you would do nothing better than confound you.
So if we have a public reading offer, teleconference with Mary McLuhan and contact Marshall with Ion and start talking, are you going to not say things like that because it'll confound people?
Well, no.
So we can't go into it with the phrase, the medium is a message.
Sure you can. We'll rip that shit to shreds, so go ahead.
Now how is the riff writing embedded in that phrase?
Very easily. The medium is in the message. What's the message? The word. Well, what's the word? Thought. What's thought? The belief system allowing and relaxing will allow things to come into your reality that you weren't even asking for or regarding. That transfer is significant at all levels, regardless of what you call it or don't call it or give a shot for it or don't. So that already is. But the simplifying process is so that everyone can come into that upper end place, okay? Then we're all for that. But it's when it's anything less than that, it's when we kind of get sideways and go, no, 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 no. Wrong way, Feldman.
So you explained it a bit in the first part of that statement.
Yeah.
I had an insight listening to Emerald Tablet number 8.
All right.
When you parallel world, if you go into another corner of the room, you're looking at the room from another angle. You are in another world, or you can slip that slightly into parallel worlds in different parts of the room.
Very subtle. Or very radically, but yeah.
So portals equals angles involves curves.
Well, of course, Bob, because look at the shift, the temporal shift, the way the ions interplay between protons and neurons.
Mm.
That's what that's all about. That's how you can walk through a solid wall into another world.
Because there are ions.
Yes, what you call free radicals.
Are ions considered free radicals?
No, but it gives you the fourth state of a free radical.
Ion gives you a state of the free radical.
Because if you really get free, then guess what? You're not bound by those radicals anyway.
So the movement of the ion, which I call in the interval between proton, neutron, and electron, is actually a symbol of someone going from world to world.
Okay. Yes.
The ion, is it goes and interacts with the proton, and then the neutron, and then the electron. You consider each a world, the ion is the thing that's in the rift. Or the ion is a symbol of the rift action.
Very good. We like the first one best, but yeah.
A symbol of the rift? That was the first one?
Yeah.
Yeah, the rift is the in-between place, the corridor that gets you to different worlds. ion's role in matter is same as the role of the rift. Do you agree?
Mm-hmm.
So when you get into mathematics and the angles, cosines and sines, and you've used these words, the tangents and all that, that are terms in math, but you relate it to movement, and that then can be related to movement between parallel worlds. So the ion, the mathematical tangential formulas that some physicists might put on it, is a metaphor for the angles that the one takes, like the ion takes as it moves.
Yes, and those angles are different dynamics that take you to different places. And let me give you something else that's interesting with your dialing a telephone number. You understand that that word still means that, even though you no longer dial?
You mean we still apply it to a world that we don't? Yeah?
Yeah. I'm going to call number one.
I'm going to dial number one.
I want to dial his number.
And you don't do that. Now, that's a point that McClune, the language leg, called living and using, projecting the rearview mirror on the present.
Right.
That's what his point was. We walk backwards into the future. Like he used to say that the car was first called a horseless buggy.
Right.
And he put whip holder places for the original cars for the horse.
Of course.
A transitional perception. So we're still thinking we got the old phone when we're looking at a cell phone, which is not a phone. Something different. We wanted to point that out. Okay. That's relevant to McLuhan, so that's resonant with the first part of the session. Now, you look at a number one, number two, three. The angles in each number forms a number. Are they showing an angle? Like one angle. That's an angle that you're going to travel to another world. Did it have that function originally when one person was, okay, this is the angle I'm going. So he made a one to indicate that angle. For parallel worlding, is that accurate?
It would be.
That's the archetypal power of numbers, because they were originally notation symbols for inter-world communication.
Yes.
Why was the eighth tablet making a distinction between angles and curves? What was the difference between curves and angles, as that writer was thinking?
One confounds and one gives percentage of degree of change.
The second one that gives a percentage of degree of change, that's curves.
No, that's an angle. First one is a curve. It doesn't have any angle.
In the tablet, at least how we were reading it, seemed that angles were dark and curves were better.
If you don't know, yes. But once you know, angles are better, because then you can calculate exactly what percentage or degree of change there is.
That gets into the elliptical partial differential equations?
Yes.
The degree, the delta, the symbol for change, the differential.
Delta, beta, delta, theta, theta, psi.
Is that an equation?
Mm-hmm.
From a less end position, knowing the angles is important?
No. From the ascended position, knowing the angles is important. Because then you can calculate precise trajectories.
For a parallel worlding?
For everything.
For everything. Why would you want to know those trajectories?
So you could know the proximity of the distance between you and you in your ascended state of your next then place that you're allowing, because now you know how to allow it instantaneously. So you can mark the degree of change so you can see how much it is that you want it precisely, rather than an ellipse where it goes around in circles and circles and circles and circles and circles, never getting anywhere.
That's the curve area.
Uh-huh.
The curve tends toward that.
Now, the little man, it works better being in the circle, because if you get lost, you're just going to end up back where you started anyway. But once you get ascended, that circle business, the wheels on the bus go round and round, is not an answer. They're going to engage.
Yeah, and you use that as a, quote, put-down phrase.
Well, we don't mean it that way, but it is.
When you want to point out how humans keep going around circles, you say that.
Yep, and yet they do. And then some listen and they go, that's so profound. And we go, yes, isn't that profound?
You mean the wheels are going around circles, people think that's profound.
Yeah.
Yeah, and yet it's pointing out a less than position.
Well, it's just round and round and round and round and round. Where were you, Bob, when lightning struck the Flying Jinny?
Is that an actual historical event, Flying Jinny? I don't.
No, Bob. Flying Jinny's when you cut down a tree and there's a stump, and you take a board and you lay across the stump and you put a pin or a stob or something in it, and you push off with your feet and go around and around in a circle. It would be like the teeter-totter, but goes in a circle. It's known as a Flying Jinny. Great fun if you don't have anything else to do. Go around and around and around and around and around. The only thing that makes it exciting is if lightning strikes the Flying Jinny. Then it's exciting.
Did Marshall go to the Guff?
Yes, he did. With his brain tumor and carotid arteries.
What happened to his other families? They carried on.
They carried right along, just happy as hogs and schlock.
But when he went to the Guff, did he leave his other families, or were they other Marshalls?
No, he left them all. That's a good question, because that is the case. You can activate multis, but he didn't.
You could activate multiple. It's not that there are different versions of Bob, but Bob could activate subsets of Bob in other worlds.
Well, Bob couldn't do that, but the other subsets would, because they're just as much a marvelous, powerful creator as you are. And that's a scary thought in and of itself. But
no, I don't know about that.
I know, but you will.
It's a scary thought that they could activate me?
That there's more than one Bob that could activate all of that is Bob.
So what I'm experiencing may not be activated by me.
No. Yours is only activated by you. That doesn't limit you because you're limitless. You can engage, but other Bobs are also as limitless as you are limitless.
And are they affecting me?
No. They are not affecting you. What we were saying was, stay with us now, is that it would be quite a something if other Bobs activated all of themselves at the same time. It would be amazing. All would stand in amazement if all the Bobs activated their real gifts and their power of knowing and beingness at the same timing.
So there are other Bobs right now talking to Ion.
Some to Ion, some to non-physical, because see, the individual Bobs in name their non-physical interaction the same way.